I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester, his name is John Anilio, and you're listening to a casual NPR-style Functional Nerds live from Capricorn 35.
That is Patrick Hester, is an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award-winning podcaster for the S of Signal podcast. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. You can check out what we do over at functionalnerds.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. And as Patrick said, we are live at Capricorn. Well, not we're live in the same room. We're not in front of an audience right now. We're actually in Patrick's hotel room, which he has a sweet. I do too. We're not sharing a room this year, though.
And it's funny because we are live, and everybody is staring at the microphone in the center of the
room. I know. It's very
don't make eye contact. Yeah, it's like prison.
Yeah. So it's a very unusual Functional Nerds, but it should be a fun one.
I'm just checking to make sure it's on.
Yeah,
it is. Yes.
And that voice you hear is John Bivins. John Bivins is the artist guest of honor here at Capricorn. And John, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the work you've done?
I've done a lot of anthology work before now. Comic Book Tattoo, which was a Eisner and Harvey Award-winning Pop Gun. Reading with Pictures, which education in comics. And Split Lip, as far as the horror. Currently, I'm doing work for Image Comics. My comic is Dark Engine, written by Ryan Burton, drawn by me, colored by Kelly Fitzpatrick. And in April, I have another series, Old Wounds, coming out through Pop Goes the Icon, a Las Vegas-based publishing company, with writer Russell Lisa.
So Image is doing a lot of cool things that are non-superhero.
Yes.
Because I've been covering a lot of Image stuff for Kirkus, because I write graphic novel reviews for Kirkus. And when I go looking for non-superhero stuff, Image keeps coming up.
Yeah. Well,
any thoughts on that? I mean, why is Image doing such different stuff?
I want to say about damn time.
Yeah?
Yeah, the I am not... I was raised with Capes and Cows. I am not a Capes and Cows guy as far as like the art and the stories I want to tell. So the fact that there are companies like Image at the forefront, and then, you know, Dark Horse is doing neat stuff, IDW is doing neat stuff, Oni, the fact that all those companies are putting out stuff that is non-superhero based and expanding the genres in the ways that European comics has had forever and the ways that Japanese comics has had forever, I think that that is a wonderful sign. And then it's along with, you know, there's the giant cinema, you know, Hollywood takes notice of all the superhero stuff, but then there's all the other things like History of Violence that snuck in there that was originally a comic, and you have Road to Perdition that it's just really a way to lay out really good stories and other media that are going to take interest. So I think, yeah, it's about time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I went through a comic book phase when I was in college. I didn't really read them as a kid. And it was superhero stuff I was into. It was when Image was just coming out. It's when all those guys left Marvel and went to Image.
And who are those guys, John? Do you know their names?
Yeah, it's Jim Lee, and it's Rob Liefeld, and it's, Wills Portacio was there in the beginning. Yeah, that's a deep pull right there.
Todd McFarlane. Originally a partner, but not a partner when it, yeah.
Yeah, and McFarlane, of course. So I was into all those guys. I was into their Marvel stuff, and then I ended up liking a lot of the Image stuff. But then, as we've talked about on the show before, Patrick, you know, eventually I kind of burned out on it because of all the mega crossovers and having to buy Power Pack. And and that's a running theme on our show, too. But in recent years, I don't really collect on a monthly basis, but when I do read anything, when I read a graphic novel or something, it's not superhero stuff. And it's not that I don't like superhero stuff. It's that... I think it's almost kind of like some of the tie-in novels and things. It's like those characters are so iconic and their story's been told a lot, and sort of the stakes aren't quite there because, you know, well, if they kill Iron Man, they're still going to bring Iron Man back. So what are the stakes in this? And like, so I've read stuff like Why the Last Man, and I've been reading Saga and things like that because it's better stories. And I like that there's a... It's almost kind of like you were mentioning it with European comics. It's almost kind of like how American TV now is I think, more starting to model British TV in that it's let's just tell a story. Mm-hmm. And whereas American TV in the past would be like, how many years can we get out of the show? If the show's popular, we want it 5 years or 10 years. Whereas British shows are, this will be about 4 episodes, I think, it'll take to sell this story. And they just tell a damn good story and that's it. And I kind of feel like that's sort of going on in comics now, too, where it's the books are limited. It's going to be like, so why The Last Man? I don't know how many years it ran for, but I know I read 10 graphic novels and it ended.
See, I always just thought that British actors were just really, really lazy. That, like, you know, like for Sherlock, I can only do 3 episodes a year and then I'm done. It's, yeah.
Come on! So when you're drawing a comic book and you've got that 2-page spread, right? Yeah. And you this last little corner here on the right, that's the one that got to make them flip the page. Mm-hmm. Is that the panel that gets the most attention from you?
Oh, God.
I know, right?
Yeah, no.
Good question.
It really is. Because, no, I work really weird. A lot of times, you know, I don't even start drawing the comic and from front to back. I'll start in the middle and stuff like that. And when I lay out the page, I do the same thing. I, like, work the entire page the whole time. And eventually, it gets to the point where deadlines are getting closer. And so the pages that I ended up starting with, which is why it's really good that I don't just go front to back, because then really good, it's getting worse. Mm. Towards the end, which, you know, that's great for a podcast. I'm doing visual hand gestures.
That's okay. We do it all.
Really, what gets the most attention are the pages that I start with and that entire page. And then slowly, as I go down, as I get closer to the deadline, and I'm like, hurrying, oh, God, I got to get 3 pages done today. Then those don't get quite as much attention, so I get my fun pages out of the way first. Mm. And then those entire pages just get, like, all my attention.
Okay, so, cool. Yeah. And because we are functional nerds and we love technology, you were telling me, and you just kind of threw it out there as if it wasn't a huge deal, but you draw on a Cintiq.
I have an older model Cintiq that I use, and that's in my studio. That actually used to belong to Scotty Young, and I went ahead, and when he got his new toys, I was able to get his old toys. And so I have that, and then in my home, I use a Yanova 19-inch screen that I draw on.
And why don't you explain to people what these things are? I know what they are.
These things are, essentially, it means I can draw on the computer screen.
And it's not like a tablet. These are super sensitive.
Yeah, extremely sensitive. The program I use is Manga Studio. Originally when I learned digital art, I used Photoshop and all that. I switched to Manga Studio, which I avoided for a long time because I had the prejudice with the name Manga Studio on it. And I was like, I don't draw manga, I draw American comics,
right,
that kind of stuff. But it turned out to be the best possible program for actually laying out comics and for the best inking lines, pencil lines, all that kind of stuff. So I use that. And when I come to conventions like this, I travel with like an Intuos tablet for doing demos and that kind of stuff, which isn't a screen. Mm. I actually have to draw separate. So I look at a screen while my hand is in a whole other area.
Yep, and I've used those before.
Yeah. And it's a whole different mindset getting used to it, mm-hmm, especially when you're used to leaning in like this, like with your face inches away from a screen and drawing. But, that's what I do. And the trade-off is actually I no longer have original art to sell of the pages that I do, which a lot of artists make good money selling the original art through stores and stuff online. So basically what I can sell is prints, which is what you gave me a good amount of well-reasoned, very well-thought-out crap about last night.
No, shit.
Yeah.
No, I gave you shit last night. That's why you're bringing it up, which is funny.
No, but it was a good point.
Yeah.
Because literally I had started setting up this infrastructure and I had stopped setting up this infrastructure online for selling prints and stuff like this.
So for the benefit of our podcast listeners and John, who stepped away at the time, I think, last night we were chatting about this and the question came up. I said, do you sell your stuff online? And he's like, no. And I said, well, you're part of the problem. Because if I see something really, really cool and I want it in my house and I want it in a frame and I go online and I can't find it, you've just pissed me off big time. I want to be able to buy it. I want to give you money. And you're basically standing there saying, I don't want your money. Mm-hmm. And in John's case, it's not that he doesn't want the money. He just hasn't finished setting up the infrastructure. So, you know, I'm a big proponent of artists
having websites where they can do their own prints and sell prints, because that is a huge amount of money for them. It doesn't just have to be sales at a con in the dealer's room. You know, you can sell stuff online. John Picasso does it.
Mm-hmm. And this went further in the conversation too, because you had told me earlier this week, earlier that night, about you two talking about Patreon. And I started talking to you about Patreon and the fact that I still need to set up that account too, because if people want to support me actually being able to continue making comics full time as a freelance artist, why am I not giving them every opportunity to do this? I mean, right. It may start off small. It may not be worth anything really starting off, but you're hoping to build that audience to where they're going to continue giving you the ability to do what you want to
do. And John, I mentioned to him Len Peralta.
Oh, yeah.
And you have supported Len, and you've gotten some artwork from him.
That's a good point, Greg. So Len does all sorts of cool stuff, and I was going to say it's kind of a way that you can work it as an artist, and I don't know if it works for you depending on how much time it takes you to do stuff, because I've hired Len a couple things, and one of the things was just a thing that he did, and I tried to do music versions of this, and I was never able to quite do it because I thought it was such a good idea. Was he did one thing, and he's done this with a couple different things. One was I think he called it 50 verse 50, where it was you know, he would draw 50 heroes and 50 villains, but they were all personalized. So he's like, I have 50 spots for villains and 50 spots for heroes. Give me a name of a hero, and I'll make him look like you, and we'll, you know, it'll do it. So I did it, and I had a music theme, and that ended up being the cover of one of my albums because it was $50.
What was your hero / villain name?
Oh, I'm trying to think of what the... it was lame. It was...
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, no, it was Captain Six String, because I wanted like a picture of me with a guitar, and I said, and he asked, he's like, well, what do you want it to look like? And I'm like, and I was really into the Battlestar Galactica reboot at the time, and I'm like, I want like one of the Battlestar Galactica kind of uniforms, and I want the guitar to have like laser shooting out of it. And it was a cool, for the subject matter of my songs, it was like the perfect kind of, and I asked him, like, even before I did, I'm like, look, I'm going to want to use this as an album cover. Is that cool? I'll give you a couple extra bucks. And he was like, yeah, that's fine. So he did that. So if you think about it, that now he had a bit of an audience, but it was, you know, 100 things, 100 pieces of art, we made $50 for each one. Mm-hmm. And that was smart on his part, because he gave people a format. Because if it's just like, hey, if you want me to do something, ask me to do something. Well, yeah, you'll get some stuff. But if you kind of give it to like, these are the parameters. Do you want to do this? And he'll do it. And like, I think he makes a living doing a lot of independent art like that. He does the Geek a Week trading cards and all that kind of stuff.
Well, there's a lot of artists making a good part of their income off of commissions. Guys pulling in like, $30,000 a year from the commission side of thing.
There's a guy who actually has a comic called Commissioned. And it's a very artsy comic. I mean, it's very well done for a web comic. A lot of times you look at web comics and they seem very simple. Even though there's a lot of work that goes into them, they seem simple, right? His seem complicated to me. So I think that it goes even beyond, you know, the normal amount of work that someone does. And then he will do commissions. And he does X amount of commissions every year. He will go to cons and do commissions for people. And they're very elaborate and very cool. And I have no idea what it costs. But again, it's another way for an artist to make money.
Well, and I think some of this is, you know, we were talking about it with our Patreon, which it's... you know, halfway set up, and we still haven't pulled the trigger on it. And part of it...
And so you're hearing that for the first time, Functional Nerds listeners, that we are looking at the possibility of doing a Patreon.
Yeah, and it's... and we're going to probably just go ahead and do it sooner than later, hopefully. But I think part of it is Kickstarter perception, because with Kickstarter projects, if they don't fund within that 30 days, then they don't go. And
Well, there's people who say if they're not... at a certain level, within a week, they cancel.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a smart thing to do, because if it's not going to go, you don't want to, and especially if you ask for, and we've talked about it on the podcast before, where, you know, we've seen people where it's like they did not calculate their numbers right. You know, because, and that's the thing that I'm always afraid of, and I am too cautious about it. Like, I am way too far the other way, because I think people will think, okay, I have 1,000 followers on Twitter, and if they each give me $10, then that's $10,000. It's like, well, that is not the math you have to do. Like, that is a screwed up math. And I think people do that math sometimes. But there is a point where it's like, well, you're doing this, and people like what you do, and you got to give them the opportunity. I think that's what you were just saying. Give people the opportunity to do it. And maybe it's not a lot at first, but if they don't have the access and the opportunity to do it, then they can't do anything.
See, and when you mentioned the misplaced, like not knowing their figures for Kickstarter and stuff like that, I thought you were going to the other part where that applies, to where people didn't understand how much the cost of what they're doing was actually going to be at the end.
Yeah.
Because that's the only part of Kickstarter that freaks me out, is that I will have to have such a well-structured business plan, because I talked to you about Erica Moen last night in her comic Ojoy Sex Toy, who they'd raised a Kickstarter for. And I think her Kickstarter made over $60,000. Her profit from that, after the expenditure for the book she made and the mailing and all the extra benefits, she had $10,000 of profit after that $60,000 that they raised for that book. And I see these Kickstarters where their goal to raise money is in the area of like $10,000. And I was like, okay, maybe you're accepting the fact that you're not going to make any profit and anything off that. But once you get into it, depending on how big your book is, once you get into mailing, whether you have to be sending to other countries, all this kind of stuff, and the time that you're actually putting in packaging and all that, you might actually be losing money.
Oh, well, yeah. And we've heard horror stories about that.
Yeah.
We know people who have done Kickstarters, fully funded. Something got screwed up in printing. They had to reprint. There goes all their money. There goes all their profit. There was also the very famous story here recently of the author who broke down her Kickstarter, and she was going to, I forget her name, but she was going to put out a sequel book, right, that people wanted, because the publisher said it didn't make enough money, so we're not going to continue the series. But she still had fans out there who wanted the book, so she's like, I'm going to do a Kickstarter. And in her Kickstarter, she explains where all the money's going, which is typical, right, for a Kickstarter. And one of the things was pay my mortgage, pay my bills, and people shit themselves. And it's like, hey, no, that's not what we're here for. We're not here to pay your bills. We're not going to do that. Well, where do you think the money goes?
Well, I think a lot of the questions that came up is maybe, I think you're always going to have people that are going to be pretty negative about it. And I think part of doing this is having a little bit of thick skin about being able to deflect that, because I don't know. If you're focused some, now I don't know how much crap she got. Like,
she actually pulled the Kickstarter.
I know she, but that's her choice. The point I'm making is, was it 100 people?
I don't know. I just know that it started making the rounds on, and people were really going after her to the point where she freaked out.
And it's the most ridiculous mindset, because, okay, another part of my life, I am currently a grad student at MCAD, Minneapolis College of Art and Design, and I have to take all these art theory classes and all this kind of stuff. And we talk about the time where art became doing art for art's sake. And it seems like anyone who's creative, or anyone who is supporting something creative, wants that mentality in place where you're creating art for art's sake. You're not creating it for money, and that is a ridiculous mindset. And in that sense, I guess entertainment becomes a dirty reward, except you're making this to entertain people, and you should be paid for entertaining people.
Yeah, there's a romantic aspect of it, of being the starving artist. And I think that is, we've kind of talked about that before, John and I. I think that that's part of the problem with publishing right now. If you talk to authors, they're always saying, well, money should flow towards the author, right? So in other words, they're saying, don't do vanity publishing. Don't pay for certain services that want money from the author, you know, for this or for that and the other thing. 9 times out of 10, they won't talk about publishing contracts, which are getting worse and worse and worse and worse from the author's perspective. But a lot of people will say, well, but I'm an artist, you know. And so there's like that weird dichotomy there. Yeah. You know, it's like, I need to be able to pay my bills. I'm going to go out and get a day job to pay my bills, and then I'm going to be a writer.
To go back around to where you were asking why Image was putting out so many good books, is because Image has the best creator contract in the industry. If you can actually get numbers to there, you will eventually end up making more money off of doing an Image book, as with the buildup of trade paperbacks and your residuals. And if you can get an audience to buy floppies, which is the hardest thing in the world, because the floppies are what will sustain you until you get the trade paperback and all that out, then you will potentially make so much more Image than you will pretty much anywhere else in the comic industry right now.
Well, and John and I have talked about this before as well. One of my favorite comic books from back in the day was G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe was written and completely controlled by Larry Hama. He did everything. When they came to him and said, hey, we're going to do a crossover with the Transformers because Hasbro wants us to, he's like, it's not touching my book. You can do it outside. It's not part of my continuity. I mean, he fought it hard. He did some great things with that book. We're not Facebook friends. You know, it's so cool. I'm Facebook friends with Larry Hama. And I did an email back and forth with him. I was trying to get him to come on a podcast. He's like, what do you want to talk about? And I said, well, I'm a huge G.I. Joe fan. He's like, I'm not going to talk about any book that I don't make money on. And G.I. Joe is one of the ones that I got screwed on. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to promote it because I don't want to give Marvel any more money.
Yep. With Image right now, if you're a couple creators who are putting out a book for them, and if you can get the sustaining floppy numbers up to about 10,000 people who are interested in buying your book and something like that, then you will be making a living doing that. And eventually, and slowly, that money will be accruing with the trade paperbacks that you're putting out with that. So you'll end up getting a good payment for the trade paperbacks twice a year, along with your monthly income that you have coming in after 3 months after your first initial comic comes out. Mm-hmm.
Now let me ask you this about Image. We were talking earlier about the guys that started Image. So who's running Image at this point? Like what's
Eric Stevens? Okay. Eric Stevenson, who was one of the guys that came onto Image early, not one of the founders,
okay,
but he was basically like the guy who was behind the scene that all the founders trusted.
Mm-hmm.
And the publisher has gone, like Eric Larson's been a publisher, Jim Valentino, but they're all running sort of like their own thing. They're all still vice presidents and all that kind of stuff. Eric Stevenson is kind of like the guy at Image Central,
okay,
who is running stuff. And of course, you know, the whole Image revitalization, you can't give enough credit to people like Kirkman and that, who was brought in as one of the top Image guys who's on their board and stuff now. The success he showed, and then that carries over to other books with other creators like Saga and that, suddenly, and suddenly you have them making a huge dent in the trade paperback market.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, because those books, because I'm a novel reader, I don't buy the floppies. It's not something I do. But I will go and get a trade paperback.
Mm-hmm. I haven't bought a floppy since they created flash drives.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, this and this is the hardest thing, too, because the trade
paperbacks... You're talking about hardest thing with floppies? Come on.
I am setting you up. But it's one of those things about comics that in order to get to the point where the comic is actually sustaining the creative team to where they can get the trade paperback out, you need to produce these individual issues and you need the people that actually buy them. And it's bad because I'm part of the problem. I love trade paperbacks. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big part of the problem. So I'm not going to tell people you have to buy the floppies and that kind of stuff, but I'm just going to say how much it actually helps. Like the pre-ordering those individual issues in that, as far as keeping a series that you love alive. So
how do you pitch a story to Image? I mean, do you have to already be part of their pool of people to become an artist there? Do you have to pitch them? I mean, how does that work?
See, the industry I don't tell this story often because the industry will hate Ryan and me for our story for actually getting in there. But how it worked for us, we had been on the outskirts of doing work in various parts of the industry. Ryan had done some comic journalism. I had done like anthology work, all that kind of stuff. We pitched it and we started to know people in the industry and stuff like that. And we pitched it on a Friday to Image. Apparently some of the people, like other creators, had mentioned to Eric, hey, you might want to keep an eye out for this. Eric saw it, and that following Monday, we got a call back saying they wanted to publish it. So over a weekend, it was decided that we would be working with Image. And the reason that a lot of people don't like that is because a lot of times it takes like 3 months or so for you to hear back.
Sure.
So it was a pitch package of Ryan wrote up the story, a brief synopsis. I did a cover, 5 interior pages, sent that off, and we heard back right off. So.
And that is very unusual.
That is extremely unusual. In fact, whenever I tell that, people just kind of, other comic creators just kind of look at me, shake their heads, and say, you really shouldn't tell anyone that.
Have you seen or heard the stuff about you have to draw a certain style?
No, Image is so hands-off.
Get there. So yeah, so I think it's Marvel and DC.
Yeah, you know, there is a Marvel style. There is a DC style. Within Image and the other studios, like, you can say Top Cow has a style, but they're starting to bring in some other people like Stephen Sijak, if I pronounce his name right. It's very European. I'm probably doing it very wrong. Mm-hmm. But his style is very different.
No one mispronounces names on this show.
Yeah. Okay. Now every time I say a name, I'm going to have to try and mispronounce it. But they have what was considered a house style, but they have people who are breaking out of that. Image has lots of different styles. They have like the How Toons book, which is more children's oriented, that is educational. And me from the various other people, like the book storyline that might be similar to us at Image would be the New Prophet relaunch that happened a while ago, written by Brandon Graham. The art there in my art is nothing alike whatsoever. So it's a wide variety.
I think with art, and I remember you going back to when I was getting the floppies, not the discs, but the actual comic books, Patrick, was...
I have a pill for that.
Come on, man. I said keep that private. Now, it was when you'd have different artists on the same book, like the fill-in artist, and it would be so different than the regular artist style, that would trip you up. But from book to book, it didn't bother me. Like, I would grow a lot. And I liked, you know, I liked all the, you know, I loved Jim Lee at the time, and I loved Greg Capullo. And all, like, I mean, because I collected for, I liked the stories, but I was an art guy. Like, I really followed, you know, artists around. On their books, not like in person. I didn't follow them, but
if I could have got the addresses and phone numbers, I would have followed them.
Right. So I mean, you do grow to love certain styles, but again, that was one of the reasons why I stopped collecting at the time, because I think that was a great time of upheaval in the industry. I imagine when Image was starting, because once they got going, you know, you'd have an artist on the X-Men or whatever book, and they'd get real popular. And then I think they would go to Image or someplace else where they can kind of create their own characters and everything. So create at the time, and I don't know if it's any better now, creative teams did not stay on books very long back then. And it just seemed like they'd just get going and get something going good, and then they would leave, and then a new creative team would come in, and it would take... Then there'd be like two or three one-off issues that didn't really have anything to do with anything. And it's like, so the book was monthly, and I just kind of at the time felt like kind of blowing my money, because there's sort of like four throwaway issues every year, because it's like they're the sort of transition. And it seems like what I liked about it was when the same creative team would stay on it, which is, I think, why I like the trades, because the trades... And now there's fill-in artists on trades, because sometimes... I'm assuming there are some months where the artist can't make the deadline or has another project, so there's a fill-in artist. But really, it's not that much, and you do get the same tone through the whole run.
Yeah, which is... Sometimes you'd have an artist take over, and their style would be so wildly different, it would almost be off-putting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to buck the trends here, and when McFarlane took over for Spider-Man... the shots of Spider-Man himself, like, hanging from webs and with all the spiders around, you know, all the details of that stuff was great. But then when you switched to Peter Parker and Mary Jane, it was almost grotesque
the way he would draw them.
And Peter's hair was suddenly all like weird and
It was the 90s, too.
Yeah, but it was like he was drawing the 80s. Yeah. Exaggerated.
He was very visceral, I think is the best word for it. It's like you could feel every disgusting piece of everything going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was so much detail, it was overwhelming.
Yeah, it's funny. I've just noticed this recently because I always thought, this is off topic now, but I always thought the 90s was a kind of a faceless decade. Just overall, like, because when we think of the 70s or the 60s or the 80s especially, it's like, that looks so 80s, that sounds so 80s. I mean, just from a music point of view, I think there are albums or songs in the 80s where you could tell the week and month they were recorded because of the synthesizer sound or whatever. But recently my wife and I were figuring out, it's like, there, it was a 90s look. We figured it out.
And it changed throughout the decade.
Yes, exactly. But for dudes, it was like kind of that floppy hair, like the, not long hair, but kind of like the floppy long hair, and like baggy, like kind of pleated khakis. We saw this thing, and it's worth looking up if you like Mad Men. There was this thing, I don't know if you saw it, it was about 6 months ago, it was kind of doing the rounds online, where Jon Hamm was on a dating show. Like, was one of the, it was like a, you know, the Bachelor show, but it wasn't called the Bachelor show, it was like some, and he was one of the three guys that went on dates with this girl, and all the dudes had, including Jon Hamm, had that floppy hair and had like the baggy pants, and the woman did not pick Jon Hamm, they picked someone else. So I'm like, that woman must tell that story to everybody now. I turned down Jon Hamm, so anyway, that's totally off topic, but 90s had a look.
See, there's a difference between like the early 90s grunge look, yeah, and they brought in the industrial too, and then you get to the late 90s Breakfast at Tiffany's or music, mm-hmm, the weird, yeah,
pop. Yeah. I'm of an age, I'm 40, I'll be 41 pretty soon, where I'm so glad I'm the age I am and not 2 years older, because if I was 2 or 3 years older, because I love metal and I loved all the hair metal, and there would be pictures of me in spandex with like teased hair and everything, but because I was, you know, Nirvana and everybody comes out like 91, by the time I started doing gigs, it was okay to wear a flannel shirt. Even though I didn't love that music, like I was able to wear jeans and a flannel shirt on stage. Which
I remember going to San Jose to visit my aunt and my cousin basically kidnapping me and saying, we're going somewhere, just get in the car. And we go, and it was to my first rock concert. Mm-hmm. And the band took the stage, and she said, what do you think? And I said, well, you know, they're pretty girls. It was her brother, mm-hmm, and it was his band. Mm-hmm. But they all looked like girls because they had the hair, like, permed out, and they, mm-hmm, were wearing the makeup and everything, and that was that style, yeah, of hair band.
Oh, you know, just kind of
glam rock.
Glam rock, yeah. Oh, yeah.
To pull all this together, I, and this is not to brag, I was just very surprised by it. I was just walking through the dealer room, and I was just walking around, I was checking out some of the books, and one of the dealers, I was just looking at the books that he had, he's like, John, can you sign this for me? And I'm like, what are you, like, okay. And it was the, a couple of years ago, and I forgot all about this, there was a thing called Clash of the Geeks, where it was John Scalzi and Will Wheaton,
yep,
with the, and they had Patrick Rothfuss and a couple other folks, and I wrote a song for that thing, and the sheet music was put in it, and it was like a digital thing. And
was it the kitten something?
The Unicorn Pegasus
Kitten.
Kitten, yeah, yeah. That was the name of the song that I wrote to go along with it, and that was included, and you can get it online and everything. But I hadn't thought about that thing in years. And so the guy asked me to sign it, so I signed it, and now I'm totally, why I brought that up now, I'm totally spacing on why. But what were we talking about, right?
We were talking about hair bands.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. So the reason I bring that up is because that painting that is done of, which my song is about that painting, which is Will Wheaton riding on a unicorn Pegasus kitten with an ugly clown sweater and John Scalzi as an orc. So I wrote a whole story in the song about that, which is as ridiculous as it sounds. The guy that did the art for that is a guy named Jeff, I don't know if I pronounce his name right, Zugal or Zugal, Z-U-G-A-L-E. He does a lot of concept art for TV shows and things like that. And he and I are pretty good friends on Twitter. But he's a guitar player and a singer too, and you can find clips of him in hair bands because he's, I think we're about the same age. Maybe he's like a year or two older. That's what I'm talking about. Like, he was of that age where he was in bands like that, where, you know, and he's from New Jersey too. So I could have very well gone to see his band play when I was like 15 years old or something. But bringing it all together, so the art is basically. Well, you know, I was thinking we'll do it reverse. Maybe now we could do our picks of the week. We normally do it at the beginning of the show.
We can do picks.
But I think we'll close off the show with some picks. So, picks.
Picks of the week.
John, do you have something to pick?
All right. My pick in general now, and this may be popular, may not, I am actually really enjoying watching the new John Constantine Hellblazer show on Friday nights. And I don't care if there's no canon or anything like that. Personally, I just like the show. And it's for the same reason, probably, that I like the Sci-Fi Channel Dresden series that they put out, which was... It did so many things that were so different from the books and all that kind of stuff. I really didn't care. I just said, okay, this is completely different. I like how they're doing the show. I like the books a lot, too. I'm just not going to consider them the same thing. And I guess from what I'm hearing, NBC might be, like, shifting around to where now that show might be going to Sci-Fi. That's the rumor now.
Or USA.
Or USA, which I'm just hoping it survives. I don't care where it goes. I'm just hoping it holds on long enough that I can keep watching it.
But they have said that if they switch it to the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi, that they're going to change the name. Call it Hellblazer to be in sync with the comics, right? And because they also would then shift the focus to more horror, less police procedural.
I could go with that.
Yeah.
Honestly, and since the first episode, I think it's continually gotten better.
Darker.
And the cast feels like they're coming together a little bit more. So, yeah, I could handle it going there.
You know, it's funny. I don't know if we were talking about Dresden last night, because Patrick and I were talking about the Dresden show, because I'm reading Stormfront now. Like, I'm halfway through Stormfront. And then I realized, like, oh, the guy, I think that's the guy from Arrow, because I really like Arrow a lot. And I'm like, I think that's the guy that played it. So I went and looked and found out that that's it. So I'm into the, I'm going to go watch the show after I finish reading a couple of the books. But from what you guys told me, it doesn't matter. Like, the books and the show
are so
totally
different.
Completely different.
Yeah, but, so that's interesting.
But like I said, I think Fred Kish likes the show.
Yeah, well, that's good enough for me. If Fred Kish likes it, then I'm going to like it. All right, Patrick, what's your pick this week?
Oh, you're going to make me pick?
I'll pick first. Okay. So I'm going to pick. I've been reading a ton lately, and I've actually been doing these book recommendations posts. So I'm doing this thing now where I'm actually knocking out about two or three books a week, which is five times as fast as I usually normally read about a book a month or something. But I've been reading fast, and I read a couple of good ones, and the one I'm going to pick is the one that I just finished, and that is Lowtown by Daniel Polansky. We actually had Daniel on the show a couple of years ago. This book came out in 2011. I don't think this book was marketed the right way, because it's awesome. It's really good. So it's a fantasy novel, but it was not really... They really toned down the fantasy. The cover was just like a black and white cover. It was like a white cover with black lettering that said Lowtown. I think the English version, the British publication of it, they actually had a dude in a cloak and, you know, made it more fantasy, which I think would have helped sales here a little bit. I don't know how well it ended up doing in the end. But it's a fantasy world, but it's almost a little urban fantasy, because it is, but not like modern day urban fantasy. It takes place in a city at the time. But it's kind of a murder mystery. The it's sort of a very flawed main character who has a drug problem and does a lot of indiscriminate killing, and but the murder mystery is solid, and it was a bit of a surprise ending, and the writing was beautiful. It's the best written book that I've read in a while. Like, a lot of the books I read are the prose is fine. His prose is really, I don't know, just he's a really good writer. If that sort of subject matter appeals to you, the writing is excellent. So once again, it's Lowtown, and it's by Daniel Polansky. Patrick, are you going to pick something?
I don't really have a pick.
That's okay. That's
we're on the road, so I don't have picks when I'm on the road.
Okay, yeah, so no road pick for Patrick. So, okay, so as we wrap up here, for John, why don't you, because we didn't mention it in the beginning, why don't you tell us your website, your Twitter, and where else people can find your stuff?
I can actually be found on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and Blogger. Now I'm actually going to have to...
And DeviantArt, although he doesn't update it often.
Yeah, I do not update it that much. And I actually don't have my URLs memorized.
Which well, what's your Twitter? Do you know what your Twitter is at the top
here? It is John_Bivens.
Okay, so start there. Start at his Twitter, John_Bivens.
Everything links together. So if you find me in one place, eventually you will find me everywhere.
Very, very good. for me this week, just go to functionalnerds.com. I've been doing these book recommendation posts where I put three or four of the books that I just read. So you go check that out. You can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio and Patrick.
SF Signal for podcasts, Functional Nerds for podcasts. Everywhere else, I'm ATFMB, all things from my brain.
All right, everybody. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.
Gunsmoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.